I sometimes say that in a past life, I worked in the entertainment industry, comedy in particular. I co-wrote and co-produced novelty records. The Homecoming Queen's Got a Gun, I Like 'Em Big and Stupid, Earth Girls Are Easy, all performed by Julie Brown. I directed comic music videos for some of those songs and ended up co-writing and co-producing the film Earth Girls Are Easy. It was a wild ride. And in 1989, I showed up at my 20th college reunion with that film playing in the Harvard Square Theater, and I was a regular on Knott's Landing. I made a speech at that reunion, asking my classmates what we were doing to live up to our youthful ideals. We'd been the class that shut down Harvard over ROTC. I came back to L.A., and I got involved with environmental organizations, and I began a move toward the work I do today. I've produced and hosted this show since 1996, and I consult and speak primarily to nonprofits and foundations, working with them on communications, encouraging them to tell better stories. Well, my transition seems mild compared with that of today's guest, Tom Shadyac. A one-time actor, comedian, the youngest writer to work for Bob Hope, Tom Shadyac's phenomenally successful writing, directing, producing career included the hits Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, Liar Liar, Nutty Professor, Bruce Almighty, and Patch Adams, and earned him 4 People's Choice Awards and a ton of money. His new documentary, I Am, recounts what happened after a cycling accident left him incapacitated for months. Though he ultimately recovered, he emerged a changed man. Disillusioned with his life on the A-list, he sold his house, moved to a mobile home community, albeit in Malibu, and decided to start life anew. Armed with a 4-person crew, Shadyac embarked upon a journey to discover how he as an individual and we as a race can improve the way we live. Shadyac meets with a variety of thinkers and doers in I Am, including David Suzuki, Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Lynn McTaggart, Ray Anderson, Mark Ian Barish. All proceeds derived from the release of I Am in all media will go to the Foundation for I Am, a not-for-profit established by Shadyac to fund various worthy causes and to educate the next generation about the very issues and problems that are explored in the film. Welcome, Tom Shadyac.
Good to be here. I didn't realize that we share a leading actor, Jim Carrey. I saw that on your resume as I came in, and I found that quite serendipitous.
Oh yeah, that path. And I was thinking, there's also The Gate. John Rotz's
right.
Visioneering thing starts out with Jim Carrey. Jim Carrey is this node that.
For those in your audience, GATE is the Global Alliance for the Transformation of Entertainment, which Jim is a founding father of along with John Rotz. And GATE is helping to distribute our movie, I Am, to the body, mind, spirit community.
Very good. Yeah. I mean, I when I first saw this transition that you were going through, I went, wow, there's the Carrey phenomenon.
Yes. Maybe we get Jim to call in. Jim, if you're out there. Okay.
So I always like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. Now, in your case, your new documentary does the same thing. I mean, it does tell your story, and we will talk about how you turned your back on a very successful career, a very luxurious lifestyle. But before we get there, I'd like to know what came before the success.
Hmm.
In other words, how did you grow up? What did you want to do when you were a child?
Yeah, interesting, because I think so much of our cultural hum may poison the original authenticity, the authentic drives of the child. I was just telling a friend the other day that what I wanted to do as a kid, I knew that if I could just have a sense of play and friendship and music, that I would be happy. Now, enter the culture, of course, and they told me that I had to have a certain amount of material success, that it looked like this, that I would have a house that looked like this, and material wealth, and I kind of bought into that, even on a subconscious level. But I was raised in what I would call a middle or upper middle class family in Falls Church, Virginia. I was raised in the Catholic faith, which I, of course, responded deeply to the morality of that faith, the love thy neighbor as thyself, even love thy enemy. But I never responded to the exclusivity and the dogma of that faith. I always, even as a kid, thought I was raising my hands, upsetting a lot of nuns, saying, well, wait a second, you know, is Gandhi going to hell? Are the little children in India going to hell?
We share something else. brought up Catholic.
You were. And, so we're both recovering.
And I can remember when I asked, when Christ came into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, what color was his ass? In fifth grade, got in great trouble for that.
Oh, that's beautiful. We're both doing ass humor. I love that. I had this background that introduced me to what I discovered was kind of contradictory thinking. On the one hand, the morality of the church was teaching me, do not store up treasures in heaven where moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal. And yet, on the other hand, my culture was saying, store up lots of treasures, because then we in the culture will point to you and say how successful you are. So that upbringing was kind of the root of the shift that took place in me. I found a power in those ideas, even as a child, again, not responding to the dogma, but to the moral message, if you will, of loving. And I didn't find that same power reflected in the vision of the culture, which told me that material wealth would bring such happiness and such joy and such meaning and such purpose. And it was a false god. It didn't. So that's one of the reasons I called these ideas into question.
Yeah, but I still, what I always find when someone, you know, reaches the top and then has it change, what did they think the top was going to be on their way up? So when did you decide you were going to write and direct? And when you first began to picture that, what did you picture?
Yeah, well, you know, look, I'm an artist and a comic, and I love that spontaneous moment between human beings when I say something and you involuntarily guffaw and laugh. I find beauty and energy a sacrament in that. So I always approach art as wanting to communicate something. So as a director, as a storyteller, as one who started as a joke writer and evolved into a writer and a director, that was what I wanted. I wanted to be able to communicate something, an idea. And for me, I wanted to be able to communicate some of those moral themes that I found powerful in my life. So I wanted, for example, in Nutty Professor, to talk about it's not so much the physical appearance of a person, but who they are, that beauty comes in all shapes, sizes, and packages. In Liar, Liar, I wanted to talk about an idea that I found powerful. The truth is what sets us free. It's always this pursuit of the truth. So as an artist, that was it for me. That has never changed for me. I didn't really have a vision of myself sitting in a mansion and flying privately and buying old master's paintings. That sort of came when things, I think, toxically came my way. And so I got kind of caught up as a snowball rolls down the hill, picking up a lot of debris along the way.
Okay, so that's easy. So you what you set out to do, which was make funny and make meaning, you were actually, that part was working.
That part's wonderful, and it works to this day. And many people think that with my shift in my life that I have stopped that. And I tell them, no, storytelling is a sacred art. This is how we connect as human beings. This is how we call into question who we are and how we evolve into this better way, as you talked about earlier. So, no, I value storytelling. I have given my life to storytelling. I simply believe that the stories we tell with our lives are the most powerful stories. You know, as Gandhi said, my life is my message. And I no longer wanted to live a hypocritical message where you looked at my life of excess and then you looked at my, if you will, my parables and the messages I was sending through my art, which are about simplicity and connection and love and kindness. And yet I was living on a hilltop somewhere removed.
It's funny. I mean, actually, when you go right back to what you were saying at the first with the Catholic Church, over so many of the centuries, having such enormous wealth and power built on those messages. I mean, that same contradiction.
Yeah, one of my favorite books is this book by Thomas Kleist. It's called The Last Western. And a pope actually gets elected who calls into question the vast wealth of the church and finds a wealth in something else, in sharing and in community. And, of course, some of the more dogmatic say, you know, let's put it this way, it's not a happy ending to this book.
To this book. At the point prior to your bicycle accident, how were you doing? Were you finding your work, your lifestyle fulfilling? Were the doubts that surfaced later already there, or were things okay?
Yeah, this is, I think, one of the misunderstandings from some articles that have been written and even some press that we released early on in the process. I was in a long-term process of changing and shifting. So the bicycle accident simply compelled me, urged me to talk about this experience of shifting that I'd have, this idea that had inhabited me and that I had woken up to, that with my right hand I may be serving the world as a storyteller, and with my left hand I may be doing a disservice to the world by living a story that is out of harmony with how we can all walk in balance together. So, you know, for 10, 15 years I was questioning things. The success and material wealth that came my way, even as early as Liar, Liar, I remember sitting down with a dear friend who was an advisor, and I said, this doesn't feel right. I feel like I should give it all back, and I don't want to walk on this path. And he advised me very much what I think is in the world model. He said, no, you have a gift for making money. You should make as much money as you can. Then you can do whatever you want with that money, which is kind of like telling Jesus, be greedy now, charge a lot for your speeches, and then we can be generous later. You know, and it never quite felt right to me. So I went on a journey, and I started questioning and speaking to my friends. And I remember even after Bruce Almighty, I went out with Morgan Freeman, and I asked him what he believed. I said, Morgan, we put words in your mouth as God, reflecting some of the things that we believe. What do you believe? And Morgan completely gutted me and opened me up. He's such a wise, solid human being. He is exactly what you see in the films. He has that power. And Morgan turned me on to, for example, a book by Daniel Quinn, which just shook the dead leaves off of a tree in much need.
Which one of them was it?
Was it the, it was the original. He said British Mail, which it did. And we interviewed Daniel in our movie.
And he's been on this show, of course.
Yeah. He's his story that he tells through essentially it's a gorilla is deeply disturbing based on the way I was raised and the model I was raised in. It's almost like realizing that you've been sleepwalking and that there's been this hum, and you accept this hum, even in words like this in our national song, this land is your land, this land is my land, this land is made for you and me. And you think, well, not really. Is it not made for the woodpecker and the aardvark? And what about the Native American? Was it made for him? Because we didn't think it was made for him when we came. We said it was made for us. So there's this hum that goes on that Mr. Quinn woke myself up to. And
my guess is that Woody Guthrie, when he said you and me, the Native Americans were probably in there.
I would hope so. I'm not so sure that we, though, with our
cultural hum, who were singing it, yes.
That's right, would say that. But it had me question everything I'd been taught, you know. And I think it was Descartes who said, if a human being wants to grow, at some point he will have to question everything. And so I began to question everything. And here I was leading this life of excess. This was long before An Inconvenient Truth came out, and we sort of internationally got woken up to what we were doing to the environment. And I started to realize that I was having an impact in a very negative way, in a way that may be causing problems where I wanted to bring healing.
That your footprint
my footprint.
What you were buying, using, throwing away.
Yes, just for example, I, like all of Hollywood, bought a Prius. You know, I thought, you know, when these ideas begin to surface that we're using gas, that it's putting out pollution and it's hurting, I thought, okay, I'm going to buy a Prius. And then I would fly privately for lunch to Telluride. And my cousin points out to me, he says, well, it's interesting, but I think that one tank of gas in your private flight is as much as a family of four uses in an entire year. And it just hit me like a rock to the head. And I had to stop that, you know, and there were so many other things, you know, having a 17,000 square foot three home compound for a single guy.
For a single guy.
If you could see Terrence now in the room, this would be, if you could get the visual, he was, as many of you are right now, rolling your eyes, which I eventually rolled my eyes at myself because it was unnecessary. And if it brought me an exponential amount of greater joy, which it does to some. They use those homes. They can be used sometimes for, you know, great communal activities and art and charity. And I understand, but in my case, it certainly did not.
Well, you say in the movie when you did the day that you bought your first house, not even that
right.
that one, which
right.
was, they got larger and larger.
They got larger.
But when you bought your first big one in Beverly Hills, and kind of the movers went away, and the, you know, it's yours, that you had a profound disappointment.
Yes, it was a disappointment. It was even beyond disappointment. It was a moment of knowing that this didn't work. A friend of mine is a big celebrity who shall remain nameless and had the same moment after he had his new sitcom deal, which was a multi-million-dollar deal. He was in his Porsche with his model girlfriend on his way to his Malibu beach house, and he realized, oh, my gosh, this didn't work. This didn't do it. And so I stood in the foyer of this Beverly Hills home, which was a former home of Mia Farrow and had a lot of Hollywood history, Marino Sullivan. And I had arrived, but there was no there. And the moment was simply, wow, this is neutral. It didn't do what I had been promised and thought it would do. I have arrived at the destination. I used to drive through these Beverly Hills neighborhoods and think, that's where I want to live, because it would point to something. And what it pointed to really had no meaning.
Right.
So that was a profound moment that I, of course, pushed aside and moved on.
That's right. By the way, I've had Robert Frank on the air. Robert Frank is a psychologist, economist, who's done some research on how much house makes people happier. And the truth is, as Tom Hartman mentions in your film, that if you're cold and freezing and someone opens the door and welcomes you in, that gives you happiness.
Right.
That gives you – and what I think Frank found was that up to about 3,000 square feet,
mm-hmm.
they can – you know, as you're moving up with your little family – it keeps making you happier. And beyond that, you don't get happier.
Yeah, the positive psychology has studied this. And so they now know the level of money even. And it's around $50,000 depending where you live. And then beyond that, look, if money buys you out of the burdens of homelessness, hunger, poverty, you need medical attention or you need an education, it can make you much happier. But beyond that, which is around the $50,000 point, it not only doesn't make you any happier, it can decrease your happiness because of the complexities that come with it.
And another thing that people always think they would be happier with 20% more. It's kind of, that's what they found, I think.
Yeah.
I had. And one thing I do, I want to go through the story, bring Mark on, but I do want to say that thing that you, that we're, well, maybe we should deal with it now because sometimes it gets left. But when I read your comments I think it was might have been at the Huffington Post, somewhere you wrote something and then there were a lot of comments. It might have been to the LA Times article or something.
Sure, sure.
But there's about every fifth or sixth comment is easy for him to say.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
in
yeah,
other words,
yeah.
I don't have health insurance. I don't know what I'm going to do with my child. I'm not excited about a guy that, you know, still lives in a Malibu wide, you know, double wide or something. What did you feel when you read those comments?
Well, they shouldn't be excited. No one should look at anything I've done and even use the word generosity. This is the new world I think we're going to birth. It's not generous. It's natural and right. If someone's hungry and I have two slices of bread and I only need one, then it's only natural and right that another person eat that slice of bread. So I fully understand what people say when they say, okay, so here's what I believe I would not say okay so to, and that is the principle. And the principle that that I'm moving towards, that is inhabiting me, operates in that same person who may have written that, and it operated in Gandhi, and it operates in me. And that is a simple answer to a very simple question. Are we brothers and sisters or not? And that's not just between us humans, but all of creation. Are we brothers and sisters or not? And that, to me, has power, and that informs the conversation. And that, I think, will move the person who may have written, you know, the article that may have had a questioning tone.
Yeah. Okay, I'm Terrence McNally. That's Tom Shadyac, once one of Hollywood's most successful comedy directors, Ace Ventura, Nutty Professor, Liar, Liar, has a new documentary called I Am, which tells the story of his transformation, which we've been talking about, his personal story, and what we'll shift into now, he went really around the world talking to 15, 20 experts, from scientists to Desmond Tutu, asking two questions. And those two questions were?
What's wrong with the world and what can we do about it? And if I may, what's wrong with the world, I didn't want to settle for the surface answers of there's too much hunger, there's poverty, there's war.
Those are symptoms.
Those are symptoms. I wanted to try to identify the deeper fundamental root cause of those problems because a theory had surfaced in my life that there is a root cause to those problems. And if we could talk about it and understand it, then we would have a chance to birth solutions. But I didn't see that conversation. You know, when I was sick, when I had this post-concussion syndrome, one of the few things I could do, locked up in isolation, was watch very low-level television. And I saw symptom after symptom. It was like going to a doctor and you got an upset stomach and he keeps providing Pepto-Bismol, keeps prescribing Pepto-Bismol, and he never asks you, what the heck are you eating? What are you ingesting? Well, we're ingesting something as a culture. And that's what I wanted to look at, talk about, and talk about how to shift that.
Okay, and we skipped over slightly. What did happen was he had a bicycle accident, Tom Shadyac, and had concussions, post-concussion syndrome, which is where the symptoms do not go away.
That's right.
And it can go on
forever.
Forever. Yeah. And it leads some people to end that forever early.
Yes.
It leads to depression and suicide and
that's
so
right.
on. And you were disabled seriously by it for how many months?
It was around 4 months when I realized I don't think I'm going to make it anymore. If this is it for me, if I'm not going to get any better, I'm simply not going to live long. And it was in facing that death, my own death, my own mortality, that I asked myself a question, which was, if this is it, if this is my last chapter, is there anything I want to leave or say before I go? And that's how I Am was born. I simply didn't want to die with this idea that had inhabited me. I wanted to have a conversation before I went, give people an opportunity to have a conversation about what that fundamental endemic problem may be, and then how we may climb out of this mess. And what I found was this incredibly positive story on when I went on this search about who we are, how we're hardwired, the story we're not being told. I believe you spoke with Jeremy Rifkin on this show, and Jeremy tells it well in The Empathetic Civilization. But it's a story we're not telling about who we are, about how we're hardwired, what makes us function. And it's a story that's ultimately very, very hopeful about what we're growing into.
Yeah, what's interesting, I think, about the story, and you ended up in your question focusing very much on that, how we're wired, how our brains work, how our neurotransmitters work, and so on. I would say that when I've looked at larger questions, you know, what does quantum physics tell us? What does, obviously, the area of brain chemistry, but so many areas, network theory, systems theory, all these things. And the thing that I have found is that when Galileo saw a truth that the world didn't see, it took about 100 years for them to catch up. A lot of this stuff, not the latest stuff on neurotransmitters, but some of the stuff on quantum physics and so on that says that we are all connected, has been around for 100 years. It's interesting that the old model is persisting for as long. We think they must have been dumb back then that they couldn't change their minds. That I often ask people, you know, what is the hold of this mechanical view of life? And so I think there's something really going on in our society that makes it very hard to learn the new story. And that story that you pursued, when you started asking what's wrong and looking for the underlying problem, you called it, and many of your guests called it, a form of mental illness.
Yeah. Well, you know, the whole spiritual journey is about waking up, you know. And so this problem you identify with human beings, which is that we tend to say no to the new, that's simply a false safety net that we have for ourselves. You know, in the book The Road Less Traveled by M. Scott Peck, the most popular book of all time next to the Bible, the word is laziness for the original sin, laziness. And you're lazy in the short term because you think, oh, I don't really want to call into question and open myself up to quantum physics and a new idea. But the long-term result of that is you lead a life that does not buzz with truth and joy and meaning and purpose. But I think people are getting shocked by the economy, by the environment. We don't have 100 years. We don't have 100 years to let this idea go. We have to wake up, you know. And the Buddha was never wise. He was considered awake. So it's much like I told you before, I felt that I was sleepwalking, you know, sleepwalking in a way that I now call mental illness. And the Native Americans and other Native philosophies.
Indigenous folks.
Yes, indigenous peoples. When someone had more than they needed, that was considered a mental illness. The term was wetiko. And when we came from Europe, the natives saw that we were infected with wetiko. And what is a mental illness? A mental illness is someone when you don't quite see reality. You create your own reality. Well, we've created our own reality. And this film, I believe, is the ultimate reality show because it wants to look at reality. And when you wake up to reality, as I think many native cultures were very deeply in touch with that reality. They were in touch with the earth, with the creative force, with life, with water, with sun, with wind. And they knew the ultimate reality was deep, deep connection, was radical dependence on all living things. And they wanted that. They wanted to be a part in the cycle, didn't want to dominate the cycle. But we have shifted that ideology. And we've created our own reality, which is giving us the very world that we see, the world between the gap between the haves and have-nots, the environment, which is inarguably being poisoned, whether or not you believe in global warming. We see war after war after war after war, genocide and genocide after genocide. These are from a mentality which has been created, again, which we talk about in the film, which we can shift. We simply have to see. I didn't see that mentality that I was a part of. You know, I thankfully, blessedly was able, I believe, to wake up to that. And now that I see it, I simply want to shift my behavior away from what I consider the mental illness to be a part of what is real, which is our connection, our brotherhood.
And the key things, I think, in this mental illness are that that reality is material, right? That it's material and that we are separate. And that the truth is that reality is alive and that we are connected.
Yes. You know, Einstein said after years and years and years of his brilliant study, he said, you know, I have an opportunity now to comment on what I think is wrong with the world. And he said, it's this illusion that we're all separate. And this was the idea that inhabited me before making the film. And if we're truly separate, then that crafts a certain kind of world. I take care of myself first. I get my business up and running. I don't care about yours. Doesn't matter. I compete against you in school. That's the world we've created. But Einstein said this is a delusion of consciousness, and it creates a prison for us. It restricts us to our own needs, wants, and desires. And our job is, as a species, is to break out of that delusion and to embrace all of mankind and the whole of the natural world. As brothers and sisters, we must widen our circle of compassion. That was the greatest mind of the 20th century's conclusion. It is the same conclusion of I Am. It is the same conclusion of a mystic that walked 3, 5, 7, 8, 10,000 years ago. It's the same knowledge that the indigenous people knew because they were so in touch with everything from their dinner that night, their food supply, to the oxygen and water that kept them alive. We have separated ourselves out from that now. At some time ago, as Mr. Quinn would tell us, that some 10,000 years ago, we separated ourselves out because we could dominate nature. We learned how essentially the tools of agriculture.
Yeah.
And that allowed us to separate ourselves out from nature, to dominate it, to say, hey, we can control this.
Well, on the simplest level, what that did was before we, as the indigenous, were susceptible to the seasons. We were susceptible to nature's rhythms. Once we came up with agriculture and began to put it the way we wanted and then save from season to season, suddenly we had this sense of independence, and from that came exploitation.
That's right.
Exploitation had very little room when you were living day to day or week to week.
That's right. It's a philosophy shift, and native cultures really had no choice, but they left their fate in the hands of the gods, if you will. And that's why we have these warnings, even in the Christian writings in the Bible. Jesus said, consider the birds of the air. They don't reap or sow, and they don't store into barns, and yet they are taken care of. Right? And do not worry about tomorrow, because tomorrow has enough needs of its own. Our whole culture is about worrying about tomorrow. We're trying to become as gods, which is we're going to take our fate in our own hand. Nothing. We are not in the cycle of nature.
That's right.
And I'm going to pull my skin tight, and I'm going to shoot it with this and that, and I'm going to just to prove that I will never die. Well, we're all going to die. We're all shuffling off this mortal coil, and it's how we shuffle it off. Are we going to shuffle it off in connection with everything, or are we going to continue in a kind of hubristic, asleep mentality and say, no, we're separate. No. Yeah.
We're at about the halfway point. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Tom Shadyac. He is the director of a lot of hit comedy films, Ace Ventura, Nutty Professor, on and on. And a bicycle accident gave him post-concussion syndrome. And in that time, a kind of gnawing that had been going on, you know, finally took over, and he disposed of a lot of his worldly excess and set out to create the documentary I Am, in which he tells his personal story and asks a number of experts in the sciences and politics, philosophy, and so on, what's wrong with the world and what can we do about it. You can learn more at iamthedoc.com. And I'm going to bring in one of the experts that you talked about for the rest of this conversation. Mark Ian Barish is an award-winning writer, editor, television producer, and environmental activist. In his most recent book, The Compassionate Life, Walking the Path of Kindness, Barish poses vital questions. What if the great driving force of our evolution were actually survival of the kindest rather than survival of the fittest? In I Am, the documentary, he's among the interviewees on the other end of Tom Shadyac's question, what's wrong with the world and how do we fix it? Mark, welcome.
Thanks very much, Terrence.
You've heard what's happened so far. Before I pose some questions, any comments or questions?
Well, I think this idea of a shift is such a fascinating notion because it's a very light kind of vocabulary word. You know, it sounds almost casual. I mean, you just shift gears. You know, we've all done that. And it's not easy, and I wouldn't want to make it appear so. We can look at the history of the world and see it's not. And we can look at our own personal histories. But at the same time, there is something very easy about it. And it is, as a Tibetan guru once showed me, as easy as sort of flipping your hand over, that you make a decision to think of the other without undue piety or, you know, self-sacrifice even necessarily. But just I was thinking of the shift once when I was standing in line and very impatiently waiting to get to the cashier and get out. And she was moving like molasses and people were muttering and there was all this discontent. And I suddenly was able to think, well, what's it like for her all day long being treated like an appliance that exists to give change? And when I got up there, I was able to say some nice things to her, and she lit up, and it was very simple and very homely. And I think that, you know, it all begins in a way with the individual human heart. What do we do with the stuff that is sort of hard to take in our own lives? Do we respond compassionately when somebody annoys us, when we're impatient? I mean, these very small little sort of inner and outer gestures are the basis for global change.
Very good. By the way, that thing that you said, which is that a shift is just a shift, you know, one cannot help but in watching this film or seeing what all the folks are saying about our connection and so on, know that at the same time, despite what looks like good news in the Middle East lately among the people, that inequity is at its greatest level in the United States. I think we've surpassed the Gilded Age and are making no moves, you know, in the opposite direction, and kind of in so it's, I think it's most exaggerated here, but certainly the haves and have-nots have never seemed so separate.
And yet we know. And you know, there's a sort of an inner knowing that is at a very deep, almost biological level. You know, we respond to others' suffering. This has been found in, you know, over and over again in primate studies and studies of animal studies in general and human studies. And, you know, we're very deeply feeling beings. And it's really the overlay of culture that has so much to do with this. You know, if you live in a Calvinist culture, as we kind of do, and the Calvinist teaching was it's all based on merit and God's grace. And if somebody is suffering, it's probably a sign of God's disfavor. And if somebody is doing well, it's a sign of God's favor, because why would God prosper a sinner? We don't, most of us, think in those theological terms anymore. But there's a kind of a subtle meritocracy overlay to the way that we perceive, say, a class division. If you're at the top of the pyramid, you might subtly sort of think that way. I earned it. I got here. I deserve this. And so the culture sort of, you know, cushions and really benumbs our natural responses. And I think that's true over and over again in an aggressive culture, in a warlike culture, versus a culture that extols peacemaking, and a culture, say, like Tibet, which had its own problems sociologically, but had as its ideal the bodhisattva. The culture hero was not Donald Trump. It was somebody who gave it all away. And that actually affects sort of which traits that we all have. We all have selflessness. We all have selfishness. Which of these traits actually emerges individually in social groupings and a culture at large? So a lot of, I think, what this film is doing, which is marvelous, and other works like it, is sort of setting a different tone, a different atmosphere, putting different ideas into circulation, into the cultural bloodstream, into the kind of collective heart and brain. And this this has subtle effects. So even as we might look at it at a moment in history where, as you say, everything is stratified and you could argue ever more pyramidal and our ability to destroy each other and destroy the planet is augmented to unimaginable proportions. You mentioned Egypt before. It shows that things can suddenly shift. There can be this moment of kairos where people just on a very simple and basic level come together. I like all of us, I'm watching this in amazement and thinking, God, this is a bunch of kids on Facebook that said, let's have a revolution on the 25th. And somehow it became a something that really borrowed very deeply, it looks to me from the outside, from the work of Gandhi and King and the compassionate ideals of Islam, where it's actually people getting together and a contagion of peace and kindness from all descriptions. So these contagions of violence and greed and these contagions of peace and kindness can occur in the blink of an eye. I think it's, you know, you can look at Eastern Europe in the late 80s and early 90s. That certainly has borne the test of time, that you had peaceful revolutions where people just, the police just decided, I don't feel like shooting my brothers and sisters. I'm going to take my uniform off and join in, you know, the Velvet Revolution. I say this and point these events out because they're so recent, and yet we forget how quickly change can occur and how unexpectedly.
Yes, and how things, I mean, it is, that in 89, it blew our minds, and our, you know, so well-financed intelligence agencies were surprised by what happened in Eastern Europe. I think if you asked them, you know, 3 weeks ago, a month ago, 6 weeks ago, they would have said the Middle East is what it is. It's you know, it's stuck. And yeah, I think it's amazing how when a moment happens, when the positive contagion it emerges in a people, that it can change the way it has. I wanted to ask Mark, just a couple of things. Tell us a little bit more in more detail about some of the key concepts that are among newest that Tom referred to earlier about the neurochemistry, about the brain wiring, about the mirror neurons, and about the heart.
Well, I think we're discovering that contrary to the story we've been told that is purported to be a Darwinian tale, but in fact isn't, because Darwin talked a great deal about love and cooperation and very little about survival of the fittest. It turns out that we're not wired as naked, aggressive apes, but as you mentioned earlier, as creatures about whom it might be said survival of the kindest is the cardinal rule. This is a phrase of Franz de Waal, a ethologist and an anthropologist who studied the bonobo apes, who are an unusually empathetic primate. So you mentioned the mirror neuron, which I think has been one of the really amazing new discoveries in neurobiology. Ramachandran, the geneticist and brain physiological expert, says that it's a discovery that ranks with the discovery of the genome. And it basically says that there are structures in the brain that respond to what happens to others as if it is happening to oneself, simply put. So that there is something in us that does not differentiate between self and other, a premise that goes up to the highest sort of ideals of mysticism, but it turns out it exists at the humblest level of the brain cell. And on top of this sort of fundamental structure are built all sorts of other mammalian structures that make us respond to each other as if we are one people, one species, one tribe, that give us the ability to empathize. And this ability to empathize turns out to be very widespread all through the animal kingdom, and especially in great apes, dolphins, elephants, creatures that have a profusion of these mirror neurons. And there is also a phenomenon physiologically that was discovered very recently called elevation. Elevation is a sensation that you get when you see a selfless deed. It's cross-cultural, and if you can think of a movie where there's a self-sacrificing hero, or when you hear about somebody rescuing somebody in a flood or a disaster, or people gathering at the scene of a disaster and helping each other, you get kind of a lump in your throat, and you feel this sense of the heart sort of soaring. And scientists have studied this in every culture. It turns out to be universal that we rejoice when we see compassion and empathy being exhibited. And this is thought to have to do with the vagus nerve and the connection between the heart and the brain that's made by the vagus nerve, and the fact that evolution supplies us with these sort of reward circuits so that we get endorphins when we do a good deed or see a good deed. And it really says that evolution likes us to be compassionate, that it's actually very good, in fact, for survival. A group with altruists is going to survive a lot better than a group full of selfish individuals. So that the whole tale that we've been told, the narration from science, that somehow we're all really built to be selfish individualists, is really kind of a lie and is belied by the new discoveries. You mentioned also the heart. The studies of the heart now as a sort of not only an organ of feeling but an organ of cognition have been proceeding apace through science. Is like neurocardiology, which has shown that the heart has an arrangement of neurons that is very cortex-like, and the heart actually secretes endorphins, and it secretes oxytocin, the so-called cuddle chemical, and that there are even sort of weirder things about the heart that organizations like HeartMath, which is mentioned in the film, have discovered, that the heart has a very large electromagnetic field that can affect and entrain the brain waves of others at a distance and can affect other living systems, so that you begin to see the truth of some of these ancient doctrines, that the heart was where the human being actually resides, and that the emanations of the heart, if you will, are powerful enough to affect the people around us and, in a sense, through a kind of a step up the entire world.
By the way, you can see why I wanted Mark in the film. He is a walking Wikipedia.
Yeah.
So if you need an answer, if you need a specific from Franz de Waal to the root cause of the mirror neuron, I simply go, when you're kicked in the testicles, you know, when someone's kicked in the testicles, I go, ouch. And that, you know, Mark knows every study about that in the history of the world. So, yeah. But you know, it's interesting. That's why I think the film may have a kind of reach that it wouldn't normally have, because I have the sensibility of the Ace Ventura audience, you know, but I can take a genius like Mark Ian Barish, you know, and put that genius out in a way that most of us can comprehend, because, you know, Mark, frankly, is a multisyllabic, you know, speaker of great import. But
when you said things continue to pace.
Very kindly put, Tom.
Mark, when you said things continue to pace, I went, you know, yeah. Go Mark.
Yes, yes.
I just don't hear that often enough.
It's too much 19th century literature. High school.
How is it going out around the country, like city by city, kind of?
Yeah, we're doing a smaller city release first. So it's opened in Portland and Seattle and San Francisco, hit L.A., and then we go wider. We go to New York, and then we go to Boston, Washington, D.C., et cetera. And it all depends on people. You know,
yeah.
People are very affected. We're getting letters saying, our lives are changed. Our school has changed. We'll never be the same. We're seeing the world a completely different way, which was our hope making this film. And we're asking those people to talk about us on Facebook, to get their friends to go see the movie. And the response has been overwhelming and humbling and so encouraging.
Yeah, that sounds like a similar path to the movie What the Bleep Do We Know from a few years ago, which started in the Northwest, percolated. I remember it did very well in Arizona, and I think that told them, okay, maybe we can go places we didn't know we could go, and ended up doing very, very well. The other voice is Mark Ian Barish, author of several books. His most recent, The Compassionate Life, Walking the Path of Kindness. You can learn more about the movie at iamthedoc.com. and more about Mark's work at CompassionateLife.com. We've got about 8 minutes. I want to ask a very specific question of you, Tom, and then I want to ask you both sort of a big question. Tell us about your father and the scenes with your father. I want to repeat it because it was so specific. At one point you say, you know, what do you think about this way I'm looking at things? And he says...
He says, I think it's utopian. And knowing man, we're not going to get there.
And what is eerie in the film is he says, I don't see the reality of it. And he sort of pauses and says, knowing man. And then in a very quiet voice, he says it again, knowing man. And this is a man who passed away.
He passed away a year ago, yes.
Yeah, my dad passed away a year ago this month.
Yeah, sorry.
We're in that together.
Yes, yes.
But talk a little bit about your father and what it meant to you to have him as a model and to have him not have the hope.
Right. I think the most important thing to know about my father was he was the most compassionate man. He walked very much what Mark is talking about in Field Notes on the Compassionate Life. He walked a life of giving and service through the creation of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, which is a charity started by Danny Thomas, who was a friend of my father's, and my father came in very early. And what makes that model unique is everyone at St. Jude is treated for free. So no one pays a nickel. If you don't have a dime to your name and your kid has cancer, you can come to St. Jude and get the best treatment available in the world. And so they turn no one away for the ability to pay. It's a beautiful model. Now, as a business, that model makes $750 million a year, which 100% of that money goes to treating kids with cancer, to taking care of families, to research, cutting-edge research. And the reason that that money comes in is because people, as Mark knows, are moved by the work that's being done. So what happens in the movie is I talk to my father about a business model, which is St. Jude, that I think can be replicated. Paul Newman has replicated it with Newman's Own. There are people like Invisible Children now replicating it with Good Work in the World, Ending the Child Soldier Problem. Simply, can we open up the idea of profits to include the profitability that comes when you help another human being?
And by the way, let me just insert that Muhammad Yunus, the Nobel Peace Prize winner who started the Grameen Bank and microfinance, about which there are issues right now. Some of the followers in the microfinance field have not followed the highest ethics. But he has a book which basically says what you're saying, which is there a way of structuring a new kind of business where social good counts, where we're not just shareholder profit counts and so on? And so this idea also is percolating in many different streams.
Wonderful. Well, it's time, because it's an insanity that we call the most profitable things we do in our culture non-profit. It's just in the very words sitting right in front of us, non-governmental organization, non-violence. These are the most beautiful things in our culture, and we only have non-words for them. And I think that's essentially what happened to my father, is the cultural message is so strict and deep and all-pervasive that he couldn't even see that he did the very thing that he didn't think we were hardwired to do.
In other words, he thought, because that moment just really hit me, you know, he thought, I did it. Danny did it. We've pulled it off, but we're freaks.
Yeah, he said that knowing man, we can't do this. And every part of my being, first of all, was sad for my father because he didn't realize who he was, what made him work, his own hardwiring that saw the beauty of helping a child. He didn't see it. And so there was a sadness in him that made me sad. But also, it became the seminal moment of the movie for me. Again, I don't want to give anything away. You people hopefully will see it. But it became the seminal moment of the movie for me because it is the story that we've told ourselves. We've told ourselves that, no, we're a greedy, selfish species, and we must structure a society based on that greed. My father built a charity based on the opposite, what Mark's talking about, love, kindness, compassion, that vagus nerve firing, that oxytocin firing. Every time he did something altruistic or witnessed something altruistic, it was like societal crack for the soul. It was a beautiful drug. It's true. It's like, this is why I think Oprah's so popular. Oprah has been the biggest drug pusher in America in a positive way. She brings stories of humanity and love and hope and kindness, and our oxytocin and our natural if you will, natural chocolate is released in our system, and we all get emotional. And so my father simply couldn't see who he was and who he is. And I believe that my father's passed on. And I think that whatever creative force is out there, he met that creative force, and the creative force said, well done. And you know that question that your son asked you? No. You were wrong about that one. You actually did it. We love you for doing it, and it's going to happen. And now enjoy, wherever you are. Anyway, I appreciate the power you felt in that moment with my father, because I felt the same.
Yeah, it was almost the second knowing man. It's like, and I knew at that point, having seen the dedication, that he passed away within months. Finally, let me throw to both of you, and I want a quick answer. I often, I ask people, did humanity turn things around? You know, if you could look 20 years from now, 30 years from now, sort of as you were saying, and if so, how did we do it? What are some, if you made up the story of the shift, what were some of the things that happened?
All right, Mark, you want to rock with
you're
it?
You're taking.
Okay, all right. Okay. You're... Well, you know, because Mark taught me much of this, you know, when look, if you look at technology right now, okay, 20 years ago, we could not have imagined what we're doing. You couldn't have imagined it. You couldn't imagine that we're talking on these little instruments, that we can get movies on these little instruments, that instant communication can happen in every port and portal of the world, okay? 20 years ago, we could barely get fax paper to work,
right?
But there was a piece of information that came that shifted everything. And I think the information such as it is in Mark's book and in the movie I Am, and that has been this wisdom that's in front of us, when that gets out, if you will, when we see this connection, when we actually embody the reality of this oneness, of this unity, things are going to shift in a way that you will not believe 20 years from now. You will not believe when you look at a business model what it'll be like, how that gap between the rich and the poor will shift, and then the true wealth will take us all over. Not this golden fatted calf that we reach for now, the accumulation of material things.
So you think that when this information gets out, that has already been in us, but we didn't know it, science hadn't validated it, that's going to
absolutely
take,
I think when
spread.
when the dust gets blown off the lens, that it this light beam that's going to come out of each individual, and they're going to build businesses and craft new schools and new economies and new ways of being with each other, it's going to be incredible. And I'm a walking example of it. And the reason is that when I got away from this idolatry of what we've been told into the reality of what happens when you dedicate your life to something greater, this greater good. I'm just one gem in this incredible mosaic. But when you feel the power of the connection with that mosaic, your life beams with meaning and joy. The best advertising for this kind of lifestyle is this lifestyle. The there is there.
I got to let it go with that. And Mark, you don't get a shot at
Mark.
This time.
All right, well,
wait.
I want to tell
I agree.
People Field Notes on the Compassion Life is a book they should read.
Yeah. So the film is I Am. Mark's book is The Compassionate Life. The websites are IamTheDoc.com, IamTheDoc.com, and CompassionateLife.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. For podcasts, articles, transcripts, and join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. That's also a world that just might work.com. If you want to receive my weekly email, you can sign up there, or you can email me at TeMcNally, TeMcNally@mac.com. Thank you to Tom Shadiak and Mark Ian Barish. Keep up the good work.